Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Retired four-star Marine General and former CENTCOM Commander Anthony Zinni believes his country is standing at many crossroads. The next president is somewhere out there in the crowd of smiling politicians. The road out of Iraq is still unmapped. Iran is just one of many big challenges for us to get right or get wrong. Problem is, the U.S. government is a broken machine, he says, and we need, the world needs, Washington to pull up its socks. This hour on Point, retired General Anthony Zinni on America's future. We'll hear from General Zinni in just a couple of minutes, but first I'd like to go to Baghdad, where four bombings have killed scores of people. Tina Sussman is the Baghdad bureau chief for the Los Angeles Times. Tina, nice to have you with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
What's the latest there?
Well, the latest is that we're getting numbers of as many as 82 people killed in this last bombing, which took place in an area known as Sadria, which is in central Baghdad. And shortly before that, there was a bomb in Sadr City, which, is, like Sadria, is another predominantly Shiite area. And that bomb killed at least 17 people, from what we know. They were the most recent bombings that we've had today. There have been two others earlier in the day that have rocked the capital, and it looks like the overall death toll could be over 100 today.
Has there been a decrease generally, Tina, in these sectarian killings, these bombings, since the U.S. troop surge in Baghdad?
Actually, no, there hasn't been a decrease. If anything, these kinds of large-scale bombings have increased, and even military officials have acknowledged that. In fact, they've said from the beginning that they expected this kind of an increase. They've described this as kind of a last gasp of insurgents trying to, you know, make a stand as the surge takes hold. The question is how long do they expect Iraqis to wait while the surge, you know, somehow stops these kinds of bombings? The big question, of course, for most Iraqis is whether the surge ever will stop these kinds of bombings. Mm.
On the political front in Iraq, the decision by Muqtada al-Sadr to withdraw his ministers or ministers loyal to him from the Iraqi cabinet, can you give us the latest on that?
The latest on that is that there still have not been any replacements named, but the Prime Minister, Nouri Maliki, has actually said he welcomes this as an opportunity to create a more equitable cabinet. Essentially, the Sadr said that one of their purposes in withdrawing their cabinet ministers was to try to force the Prime Minister to create a cabinet that is not, you know, based so much on sectarian divisions. And they're kind of hoping to set an example by doing this. They call it a sacrifice, essentially, for the betterment of all Iraqis. So the question now is what the Prime Minister will do with those empty seats. Will he give them to technocrats who are better suited for the jobs based on their expertise, or will once again he resort to the kind of sectarian quota system which has been causing so many problems for the Iraqi government?
And what's al-Sadr's motive for pulling his ministers out of the cabinet, Tina?
That's the big question. It depends on whom you ask. Obviously, the Sadr people say their motive is purely, you know, to improve things for Iraqis by creating a government that is not so divided along sectarian lines. There are others who speculate that, you know, this is a political game by Muqtada al-Sadr, that he is positioning himself to be seen as the most legitimate political opposition leader, and that he's also trying to perhaps win back support from loyalists, you know, the grassroots loyalists who might have been distressed by his relative silence in the last couple of months. You know, he withdrew his Mahdi Army militia during the surge, and there, you know, in the wake of the surge, of course, there's been a lot of attacks like the ones we're seeing today, targeting mainly Shiites. A lot of his supporters on the street are saying, well, you know, it's about time that we started to retaliate. So there's some who speculate that maybe this is a first step toward that kind of resurgence of Muqtada al-Sadr, to try to prove to his followers that he still is you know, the fiery radical leader that they view him as.
And finally, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is on a Middle East tour. Any news out of that trip?
Well, the latest, he's actually in Cairo right now, and, you know, the latest he said today in a speech in Cairo was basically repeating the assertion that he's made many times over that what they call the failure in Iraq of U.S. troops and the U.S. presence would just unleash sectarian strife that could spread throughout the Middle East. So, you know, he's repeating the U.S. government stance that to pull out would be a mistake. He's also said yesterday that the action of Muqtada Sadr to pull his members out of the cabinet could actually be a good thing because it could force, you know, a more equitable distribution of the cabinet and give Maliki the opportunity to just create a more effective government.
Tina Sussman joining me from Baghdad, Baghdad Bureau Chief for the Los Angeles Times. Tina, thanks so much for your time and for this update. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Joining me now from Arlington, Virginia, is General Anthony Zinni. From 1997 to 2000, he was the commander-in-chief of U.S. Central Command, in charge of all U.S. forces from East Africa to Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Central Asia. He's got an astonishing resume that has demanded the skills of a diplomat, a field commander, an aid worker, and much more. His book, The Battle for Peace, A Frontline Vision of America's Power and Purpose, is now out in paperback. General Anthony Zinni, so nice to have you with us. Thank you, sir.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to ask your reaction first up on this news this morning from Baghdad, this new wave of violence there.
Well, I think obviously the bad guys out there, this is what they're trying to do to defeat the surge or any change in strategy on the ground by General Petraeus. I think it remains to be seen if it's a last throws, as was reported, or they can sustain this. I think the key is going to be violence versus sort of the reconstruction economically and politically and the rebuilding of the security forces. If that kind of growth and reconstruction can effectively outperform the violence, if you will, then I think there's hope we could move forward. But how much of the violence can we sustain back here politically, and can the people of Iraq take before it just descends into even worse chaos?
Violence versus reconstruction, you say, but the troop surge itself in Iraq, is it having the impact that it was meant to?
Well, I think the mistake we've made back here is we ended up debating the troop surge. The troop surge is a tactic. You could argue for a troop surge if you intended to withdraw, to protect the withdrawal, or if you intended to reposition or redeploy, as some politicians have suggested. The surge itself should not be the debate. It should be the strategy. What do we see for the future? Are we going to reconstruct some sort of security arrangement for the region? Are we going to get a more viable, sustainable, and understandable Middle East policy? And how does Iraq fit into that? Will we move to a position where we try to extract ourselves from the sectarian violence, from being in between, and more toward containing the things that could spill over, like an al-Qaeda sanctuary that strikes out from there, or the Sunni-Shia strife, or the Persian-Arab strife that may threaten the region and our interests out there? I would hope that Secretary Gates, this is the level of discussion he's having in the capitals while he's out there. Unfortunately, back here between Congress and the White House, it's the arrangement of the deck chairs rather than how you salvage the ship.
Mm. Well, we're in the middle of a presidential campaign, as you know, where one side says, stay there, support the surge, stick it out. The other side says, we've got to get out, set a date for withdrawal. Is either side tenable, General Zinni?
No, it's not. I mean, stay in this course has been a failure for 4 years. We need to readjust the strategy. We need to have an intelligent bipartisan debate on that. Pulling out is naive. You know, we're not going to disband CENTCOM and come home. We have political, economic, and security interests in that part of the world that we can't leave. It doesn't mean we continue doing the same. We will support Iraq. We will support the reconstruction. We need to rebuild the alliances out there. There needs to be more burden sharing. The things that could spill out of Iraq threatens the region even more than it threatens us. But it's naive to think that that this part of the world could be abandoned. This is not Somalia. This is not Vietnam. And we need to have a more intelligent construction of the security arrangement that allows us not to shoulder the entire burden or to be the only one out there that's intervening and interfering and creating unilaterally more problems than we're solving.
So pulling out is naive. We've got political, economic, security interests. So then realistically, having said all that, how long do you see the United States in Iraq? What's your sense of a timetable?
Well, I think it's going to take, you know, if you ask me to guess, I'd say 5 to 7 years for Iraq to become fairly stable, reasonably stable. That doesn't mean 5 to 7 years of this kind of commitment is necessary or this kind of strategic approach. You know, from the beginning, this has been a military venture. We have not effectively brought the other elements of power to bear, our economic power, our diplomatic power, our influence. We did not help reconstruct the economic, social, and political sides well enough, if at all. We saw the confusion of the Coalition Provisional Authority and others, the lack of our government to operate in an interagency coordinated way. I think that's why you see this move toward a war czar and other things to try to cure those problems a day late and a dollar short. But I think we need to step back and think more about what do we do to win the hearts and minds here. What the Iraqis need is hope, and that hope comes from jobs, a reconstruction of their economy, a government that's more responsive to their needs, the security forces being more capable on the ground. And that doesn't only mean guns. You know, they need the kinds of forces that sort of capture hearts and minds in pieces. They need the kinds of things that are generated from civil affairs, psychological operations.
My guest is retired four-star Marine General Anthony Zinni, former commander of the U.S. Central Command and author of The Battle for Peace, A Frontline Vision of America's Power and Purpose, which is now out in paperback. General Zinni, just to continue with this thought, these themes from Iraq, you've used the word chicken hawk to describe those in Washington who support the war. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Well, I think we've seen the rise of people that have not experienced war or combat or, in many cases, even military service. Now, I'm not saying that's necessary for our political leadership, but when you go off on a venture that involves committing our military forces, I think you have to have a clear understanding of what that means. As we can see, or at least in my view, from the way we've handled Iraq right from the beginning, there was no understanding of the number of troops required, the length of time this operation could take. There wasn't really a grasp on how operations and combat function. If you remember General Shinseki's remarks about the number of troops that would be required, which was right on the mark, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, said it was wildly off the mark. Well, I'd rather take the word of that four-star general as to what the troop requirement is on the ground than someone who has never served, never worn the uniform. And again, that advice was ignored from the top and best echelons of our military.
Well, have there ever been any moments, General Zinni, when you have been confident that what America was doing in Iraq was the right thing?
Well, I thought that, you know, going back to President Bush 41, the first President Bush, I think he understood what was involved in this. You know, there had been criticism about him not marching to Baghdad during the Gulf War. But I think he clearly understood that he did not want to inherit that problem. He did not want to become immersed and committed to trying to rebuild a nation and to unleash all the problems that could come with that. And I think his decision to abide by the UN resolution and to effect a containment that effectively, as we look back, allowed Saddam to wither on the vine as a potential threat. I mean, he had no weapons of mass destruction. He had no program. His military was a shell of its former self, as we could see by the speed at which our magnificent forces made it to Baghdad and took down that regime. I believe it was 19 days. You know, so I think you have to be smart about how you employ forces and where you pick your fights. But more importantly, if you decide it's necessary to intervene, and that's the president's decision and the Congress's decision, then understand what it's going to take. Don't be naive, and don't sell the American people a bill of goods about how short it's going to be. There's going to be flowers in the streets. Troop levels are not going to be that long. Mission complete when everybody knew you had just begun this fight.
You talk about the intelligence before Iraq. The week before last, Vice President Dick Cheney was on the Rush Limbaugh program, and he talked again about one of the most hotly debated questions in U.S. foreign policy, whether al-Qaeda was in Iraq and working with Saddam Hussein before the U.S. invaded.
Just to give you one example, Rush, remember Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, Jordanian terrorist, al-Qaeda affiliate, ran a training camp in Afghanistan for al-Qaeda, then migrated after we went into Afghanistan and shut him down there. He went to Baghdad, took up residence there before we ever launched into Iraq, organized the al-Qaeda operations inside Iraq before we even arrived on the scene, and then, of course, led the charge for Iraq until we killed him last June. He's the guy who arranged the bombing of the Samarra Mosque that precipitated the sectarian violence between Shia and Sunni. This is al-Qaeda operating in Iraq, and as I say, they were present before we invaded Iraq.
General Anthony Zinni, is that true?
Well, I think that you have to step back and say what would be the advantage to Saddam Hussein to promote al-Qaeda in his own country and to let them use it as a base. I mean, first of all, he knows what kind of reaction that would cause from us. Secondly, al-Qaeda is advocates the overthrow of regimes like Saddam's. He would be breeding within his own nation his own end and the destruction of his own Ba'athist party and the more secular approaches they took. So it's hard to understand how that happened. Many of the things the vice president has just mentioned in the piece you've had on occurred after we intervened. Do you think Saddam would have allowed Zarqawi to blow up mosques inside the country and cause more turmoil and generate the kind of problems that would have led to his overthrow internally? There's been no clear evidence of that kind of link. And besides, the real threat to us, those that perpetrated 9/11, were operating in Afghanistan and in the border regions along the Pakistani border. We had to finish that job. We knew where that line led directly from 9/11 to those mountains on the Hindu Kush. And we got distracted from that. And we can see what's happening in Afghanistan now. There's a resurgent Taliban and al-Qaeda. The treasure and the effort and all the distraction pulled us away from where we could have made a bigger difference.
What did you think, General Zinni, of the Iraq Study Group report?
I thought the Iraq Study Group report was a good start for several reasons. One, I thought politically, since it was a bipartisan effort, it would be much more acceptable and bring the Congress and Democrats and Republicans and the White House together on some sort of mutually acceptable path. I thought some of the parts of the study were worth it, an effort to create a dialogue, to put more emphasis on the diplomatic front. I didn't think it went far enough, frankly, but I thought if you embraced it, you would then move on to other areas. I thought there should have been more emphasis on economic reconstruction, more emphasis on building regional partnerships and burden sharing in this and understanding the mutual security benefits that could be offered as a quid for that out in the region. But why it wasn't embraced fully and wasn't used as a stepping stone to readjusting the strategy, I don't understand.
Well, why do you think it wasn't?
I'm not sure. Frankly, to me, I thought this was an easy one for the administration. They know they needed to change policy, needed to change strategy, needed to even change leadership in terms of the elements of the war. They did those things. And here was a policy and a strategy offering that I think allowed them to stay committed, to articulate our interests, and to have bipartisan support for it. So why they half-stepped or didn't embrace it fully is a mystery.
I'd like to turn for a moment to presidential politics and ask you from your perspective, General Zinni, what do you think America needs in its next president?
I think we need a president with vision. If you go back to the end of World War II and you think about the Truman administration, he saw, as did George Marshall, George Kennan, and others, great strategic thinkers, that we faced a brand new world. And we needed to change our government structure. We needed to reach out to the world in a different way. If you remember the Marshall Plan, the European Recovery Plan, the creation of NATO, a military alliance, those things were alien to us. We tended to be an isolationist society. President Wilson, after World War I, failed to get us to adjust to the changing world. But Truman succeeded. And I think you need a Truman-like a vision that, and a president that surrounds him or herself with the kinds of strategic thinkers that understand that ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, this world has been changing. The effects of globalization, the effects of migrations and movements, the rise of access to technology in the information age, the rise of non-state entities out there that we deal with, warlords, drug cartels, terrorist groups, even groups that are out there trying to do good, non-governmental organizations that can actually shape and form world opinion, can rebuild nation states and governance systems and economic systems. This is a new world, and we have this sort of archaic, bloated bureaucracy still promote practices like patronage and earmarks that defeat our ability to adjust to this world.
Do you see that grander vision, General Zinni, in any of the current candidates?
I haven't heard it. I'm not saying that, there aren't candidates that might not embrace it. The only advice I would offer is don't get immersed in the here and now. It's too easy to get into the debate about what we face today and try to manage things from a day-to-day basis. And that's an unfortunate part of this political cycle, which seems unending now. We roll from one political cycle right into another. Too many things that are too important for our security and well-being are over-politicized. We need candidates that step back and think more strategically, have more vision, think more about the future. They need to be shaping the future now. We can see, and it's not only what we see in terms of foreign policy, but the domestic issues we have here. We should learn something from Katrina. I mean, the only effective organizations in dealing with Katrina were the National Guard and the Coast Guard and the Army Corps of Engineers. You know, where was FEMA and the other government agencies? Why did we have the failures of 9/11 and coordinated and integrated systems and intelligence and homeland security? You know, we got plenty of government in terms of cost and structure and people, but is it structured the right way? And I would hope a candidate would take an honest look and encourage a bipartisan view at reshaping our ability to deal with the world. And it goes back to government structure, policies that we have that are dysfunctional, that need to be changed.
And I've heard you say beyond the government structure and policies that it is possible to have a highly intelligent, well-read, capable analyst or political operator who is still fundamentally misunderstanding the global issues and the challenges, really, that face our country.
Sure. I really feel that you need a mix of the practitioner and the theorist. We have a lot of smart people in Washington. The think tanks are full of them. The government is full of them. The academic institutions are full of them. But if they tend not to blend their intellect and their study and research and their ideas with practical experience, then you get the kind of approaches that sound good, work well, read well in op-ed pieces and papers that are produced. But in putting them practice on the ground, the practitioners, the military personnel, our diplomats, journalists, aid workers that all see it firsthand, that smell it and breathe it every day, know it won't work. Just look at what we attempted to do in Iraq. We came with this noble idea of implanting Jeffersonian democracy, and we shorthanded it into believing an election was democracy. Is that what would really work? Would that be culturally acceptable? Is it the kind of society that was ready for something like that? Shouldn't that have to evolve over a much longer period of time? Were there more ways to stabilize it, taking the practical experiences of what this society could bring about in the short term? And so what I advocate is a more coupling of the practitioner and the theory in designing these. Going back to your point about the lack of experience in the military, that's where those that have ideas on strategy and policy need to bring in people that have lived in the foxhole to understand how it would or would not work on the ground.
In your book, The Battle for Peace, you also advocate a one-term, six-year presidency. To your mind, General Zinni, why would that be effective?
Well, what I see, in talking to other Americans, what I see is we look at all the issues that are facing us today, whether they're external or internal, and we see a president that is caught up in the politics. The president has to campaign. The president has to defend his own party's political positions. It's over-politicized. It's not something I just accuse this administration. All administrations have evolved into that in recent times. I would rather see our president, once elected, step above politics, be a true statesman. And I would create a one-term presidency so that president is not running for re-election, a six-year presidency. I would eliminate political advisors from the White House and the necessity for the president to campaign. He would truly become a president for all the people, totally focused 24-7 on the issues that concern our country, our well-being, our security, our prosperity. And I think that would serve our system better and serve the people better. I said in the book, and I believe this, I mean, more people know who the political advisor is in the White House than the national security advisor, I would bet. And is that really what we want from our head of state? Does that really serve bipartisan interests the best and the interests of our nation the best?
I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. My guest is four-star retired Marine General Anthony Zinni. His new book, The Battle for Peace, is out in paperback. General Zinni, I'd like to ask you for a moment about our military, whom you've referred to in this conversation. But I'd like to ask you specifically about if our U.S. Army and our military generally, many say it's stretched almost to the breaking point. Do you agree, sir, with that assessment?
I agree. You know, we are putting a tremendous strain on the magnificent young men and women we have serving in uniform and our leaders that are serving in uniform. And my son is a Marine officer and has served in Afghanistan, will be serving again in Iraq. You know, and you watch the strain. There's a rule of thumb that you need three units for every one you have deployed. We're nowhere near that. And the reason for that is they have to recover from those deployments, rebuild, reman, refit, retrain, have some time with their families, some quality time to readjust. When you have them on a constant rotation in and out without the opportunities to do those things in between, you're putting them on a track that they can't sustain. We can see the equipment problems. We can see the training problems. We can see the morale problems. We've been in this war for 4 years in Iraq. And really, if you go back to 9/11 as the beginning of the war, you see even more. What have we done to adjust our military? Have we grown Army and Marine Corps forces that are needed on the ground? Have we adjusted to the tactics? Have we looked at technological or technology innovations that counter IEDs and other things we face on the battlefield? I don't see the same kind of adaptation that we've had before. Think about World War II. Where was our military on Pearl Harbor Day? And where was it 3.5, 4 years later? I mean, it transformed itself into the most magnificent military organization on the planet. And here we're struggling. I mean, despite the fact we say the words about a long war, we haven't added anything to help alleviate these problems that we're creating that we're going to pay a heck of a price for in the future.
And can we sustain the number of troops that we have in Iraq for years to come, given then what you've just said?
We can't with this force structure, and we can't with this approach and strategy, and we can't without the other elements necessary in Iraq for the Iraqis to succeed happening, the economic and political and social changes and the ability to help them through these things. You know, how many times have we heard from our generals and colonels on the ground out there that there is no military solution? The military can buy you time. It can create a security environment. But something else has to happen. It isn't just security alone. Institutions have to be built. Again, political, economic, social institutions. It never existed in some cases in this country. If that isn't progressing and happening, just running a police state and having the security in there won't get it.
General Zinni, callers are lined up to join this conversation. I'd like to turn to the phones for just a moment. Ron is in Wakefield, Massachusetts. Ron, you're on the air. Hello.
Hi, good morning. Now, I just wanted to say, kind of picking up a point on the battle for hearts and minds, it's always occurred to me that this, I guess the whole war on terror and, how we've approached the Middle East has never really been framed in terms, I think, that Muslims of all sects, I think, in the Middle East could actually identify with. I think you can talk about democracy and you can talk about all of the things that go with democratic institutions. But if it's not framed in terms of Islam and Islamic institutions, I don't think it really resonates with the people. And it looks like a foreign concept that's trying to be imposed on them. And I think also from people who live in the Middle East and Southeast Asia, when they look at what was going on to Muslims living in this country, in the press, there was this, roundup of people who had, dubious immigration status. There were people who were deported. There were stories of, beatings and all sorts of things. And I think that, you know, the entire package just basically was not communicated in a way that was very productive.
Ron, thank you. Thank you very much for your call. Appreciate your thoughts. Let's turn to Jack in Nashua, New Hampshire. Jack, you're on the line with General Anthony Zinni.
Hi, thanks for the call. My son was a Marine, 98 to 202, and then joined the National Guard out of Rhode Island, was wounded in Haditha, and fortunately it was superficial wounds. He is now out. But my questions are, how should these people that conducted this war, made the policy, should be held accountable? What's his opinion of General Pace as chief of the general staff? Because I thought if a Marine were in there, we might get some straight shooting, but it doesn't seem that way. And also, do you think General Shinseki will ever come out with a book? Because I would love to buy it, and I would also vote for you for president.
General Zinni, that's a lot to think about. First question, Peter Pace, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, your thoughts.
Well, I think I won't comment on individuals in uniform. I do think that the senior leader, military leadership, has to be part of that accountability. Many of the decisions, we can point a direct finger to the civilian leadership, and that has happened. But I think the military bears some responsibility. The biggest debate within the military right now, and I speak to groups of officers at our war colleges and elsewhere, is how should a senior officer approach this? There's deep concern. We certainly do not want to challenge civilian leadership. That's an instilled and ingrained part of what we believe in. But we need to find a way for the voices of the military to be expressed if they see that the policies are flawed and the implementation is going to lead to disaster. I get this question from many congressmen and senators these days as to how do we structure a way that the Rick Shinsekis of the world, since you brought it up, can clearly state their views and then there are not repercussions on that. The system requires that if you're nominated by the president, you're confirmed by the Senate. The Senate asks you before confirming you, almost exactly word for word, will you come before this body and give your honest views, even if those views are in opposition to administration policy? And you swear to do it, or you wouldn't be confirmed. So there is a means to do it. General Shinseki took it. He voiced his views on troop strength and numbers during that time. And I think that we have to respect that. I often tell the story that in my time at CENTCOM, I disagreed with administration policy, previous administration at the time. And the Secretary of Defense, Secretary Bill Cohen, although he agreed with administration policy and he was part of it, he allowed me to have a hearing with Congress and even with the president and said, this general has differing views and what the policy is, you need to hear it. I think that can be a part of our strength. There are different views out there, and the military needs to have a means within the system to do that. It shouldn't just fall to retired officers to express those. There needs to be a way within the system that again, I'll go back to your point, Jane, about the practitioner and the theorist. This is where the practitioner is saying, your policy is going to lead us in a direction that you don't intend or you don't see the consequences of what you're about to do. And let me thank the caller, too, for his son's service. That means a lot, especially in these times.
A caller would also vote for you for president, General Zinni. Many are talking about it. Do you think about it? Is that something that you might consider?
No, I don't. I mean, I'm discouraged about what politics have turned to in this country. I think in many ways it's a demeaning process. It becomes overly personalized. It's vicious. I think it is now descended into something we didn't intend it to do. There are a lot of reasons for that. I also think if you have strong views, people always suspect political ambition or motivation. And when you can clearly say up front you don't have those ambitions or those motivations, maybe they hear you more and will listen more. So I choose not to engage in any kind of political process or to run for office in any way.
William, calling from Davenport, Iowa. William, you're on the air with General Anthony Zinni.
Hi, General. Hi. Very much in sympathy with what you're saying. Why can't we have a draft? Why can't we have rationing? Why can't we win this war by force of sacrifice rather than by as much by force of arms.
General Zinni, do we need a draft? Is that what it's going to come to?
No, I don't think we need a draft, but I think there's the caller brings up a very important point, which I think is at the heart of this. You know, in our society and the way we're structured, you have to take a nation to war. You can't just take the military to war. And the nation doesn't feel like it's at war. I mean, the callers mentioned sacrifice and total involvement. The only people really at war are the families and the members of the military that are actually engaged. I often get the question, you know, well, what can we do? We're told to go about our lives normally, yet we're told every day we're at war. And it doesn't sort of sync with things that we know and understand and where our history has taken us. I don't think the military itself could accommodate a draft. The draft and an all-volunteer military do not mix, and I don't think you need it. But having said that, I do believe we should have a program of national voluntary service. I've taught in 6 universities since I've retired. I am amazed at the number of young people that want to serve in some way. I mean, some want to put a uniform on, but some want to help our government. They want to help in a humanitarian sense. And I think we should create some sort of national voluntary program that allows each individual that wants to contribute and become involved to be channeled in the area that most suits that individual's sense of service. And I think if we did that, we would be surprised at the number of volunteers. Most are looking to serve and contribute. And again, to follow up on the caller's point, to become engaged, to sacrifice, to offer their piece into this, but they can't quite understand how to do that. That should be a function of our government to create the kinds of organizations or the paths that allow them to do that.
General Zinni, let me ask you about Iran for a moment. Do you fear from a military perspective an accidental war or a planned war with Iran or neither?
I fear first of all, an accidental one. When tensions heighten, and we just saw this incident with the British sailors and Marines, when tensions heighten, there can be a miscalculation. A miscalculation can rapidly escalate. And so you need to do everything to reduce tensions. You know, for example, when I was the commander of CENTCOM, we had this hostile Iranian force, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, in the waters of the Gulf, and they used to bump our ships, hostile bridge-to-bridge communication. It was a tribute to the captains of our ships out there that they didn't react. I mean, they would have been justified under rules of engagement if they saw hostile intent to engage one of these boats, patrol boats and others, and we could have had an escalation on our hands. They showed remarkable restraint and the ability to deal with it before we settled it out and reduced tensions in the region. I do worry that we have – I want to go back to your point about chicken hawks since I said that term a while
your
back.
Your quote, yes.
Yes, my quote. I worry about people that advocate the use of force that have no understanding what happens when you unleash that kinetic energy, no understanding of the second, third-order consequences, no understanding of what combat is involved and what that can bring about. And I see too many people that swagger that really don't have a right to swagger. And to me, there is a danger in that. If we did a strike on Iran, what does that mean? What would they do in retaliation? Then what we do to counter-retaliate? And where does that lead us in the end? That doesn't mean Iran doesn't need to be contained and doesn't need to be faced because of the threat it poses. It has hegemonic designs on this in the region. But how best to do it? You know, why are we talking to the Iranians as if they were all Ahmadinejad, the president? Most young people in Iran want reform and change. They're on the internet. They use cell phones. They're discouraged by a government that has failed them. What are we doing to appeal to them, to help their movement and the change and reform, to work with exiles that do have influence in this part of the world, to work with others in the region to try to contain them, communicate to them, and offer a united front, either regionally or internationally?
Well, what about the buildup, the nuclear buildup in Iran and more broadly in the Middle East? Saudi Arabia hiring atomic contractors, Turkey preparing for its first atomic plant. Egypt has announced plans to build as well. In fact, about a dozen states in the region, as you well know, are pumping up their nuclear programs. Is it cause for concern?
It is cause some concern. And I think the reason you see this outside of Iran, but in the Saudi, Egyptian and other areas, is they're worried about their own security. I think we need I want to go back to the point I made much earlier about the need for a security arrangement, some sort of cooperative agreement. where we can make some support guarantees in terms of defense. You know, we did this in NATO, and we've done this elsewhere in the world. Japan hasn't gone nuke, neither has South Korea, because we have ensured their security at that end and prevented proliferation. I think these are the kinds of structures we have to work with. The United Kingdom, the United States, NATO, and others can offer this umbrella of protection, create the right security environment. You had the added benefit where there's capital and resources out there where they could share some of the burden for this. You know, when we created the Gulf Coalition between the Gulf Wars and were involved in the containment, those nations offered up hundreds of millions of dollars to support our presence out there. They supported us when we went to places like Somalia. They sent forces and troops there, the Egyptians, the Emiratis, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis. They sent forces to Kosovo to support us. The first Gulf War, it was entirely funded through the resources in the region. There are many advantages to coalitions and partnerships. Unilateralism refusal to look at regional security and provide the parts that we can create this dash for proliferation, create the breaking away of alliances, because these countries fear the hegemony of an Iran.
Let me ask you more broadly, sort of worldwide, what you see as the coming threats, not just in the Middle East, but threats that perhaps our listeners may not be thinking about but need to understand a little more about.
I think that, you know, the biggest thing that threatens us now is instability. It used to be that if parts of the world went wobbly, it didn't mean much to us. They were remote places. We had two mighty oceans. Virtually no area of the world today doesn't have an effect to us. It can affect the environment. It can affect our security. It could affect our economic well-being. It could result in drugs on our streets because they're growing cocoa leaves and poppies somewhere. The planet has shrunk. So it's in our interest to try to have the most stable world we can. Instability results when societies can't cope with a hostile environment. They can't cope because they don't have the institutions that are viable enough to deal with it. We have to be in the business of being the leader in this area, creating the international and regional partnerships that allow us to build institutions in parts of the world that are facing potential instability or crisis. Or eventually it will wash up on our shores. It's not out of altruism. It's out of a practical understanding as to what's in our interest, in addition to being the right thing to do. If I had to say, I want to go back to my point about needing a leader that looks to the future and has vision. Look at the debate now on climate change. I just finished being on a study with 11 other senior retired generals and admirals. We looked at the security implications of climate change. What's it going to mean for the military, the effect on the military, and the effect on our military and the kinds of missions that might result? Are we thinking ahead? Are we preparing for it? It's not to debate the science. It's to look at what we would need to offer in the way of what security issues are going to be raised by that. If we don't look ahead, then as the world changes and evolves and the threats change and shift, they're going to wash over us. And as I said before, we're going to be ill-prepared to deal with them because of our structure, because of our policies, because of our lack of a strategic vision and view as to what we're going to face out there in the future.
General Zinni, I wish we had another hour with you. So much to talk about. But I'd like to end in the last couple of minutes here with a personal question. I read your bio, your extraordinary service to our country around the world. I wonder if there's a particular moment that stands out to you or about which you are most proud during your many years of service?
You know, obviously the proudest thing I've ever done was command young enlisted men in combat and watching them perform on a number of different battlefields. The bravery, the courage, the sense of brotherhood that I saw will always be, you know, burned into my soul. I think in addition to that, I was fortunate enough to be involved in several missions that involved humanitarian operations and disaster relief. And I think there's nothing more fulfilling than saving lives. I was with the Kurds in northern Iraq. I was with Somalia in the initial interventions and the humanitarian piece and many other areas. And when you know that your intervention has saved lives, has given a future, especially when you see children, that moves you. And I think that strikes close to the heart.
General Anthony Zinni, retired Marine four-star general, former commander-in-chief of the U.S. Central Command, former special envoy to the Middle East, author of The Battle for Peace, A Frontline Vision of America's Power and Purpose. General Anthony Zinni, it's been our pleasure to have you for the hour. Thank you very much for your time, sir.
Thank you.
And all the best.
Thank you.
Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.